pray now for Larry as he speaks to us. We pray that the words that you have laid on his heart, you will enable him to do, bring them forth for us. Give us open hearts, open minds, and open ears to hear what you would have us to hear today through Larry. We just commend him to you now and give you thanks in the name of the Lord Jesus.
Good morning, everybody. So hopefully I'll be in business with this thing here. Right, excellent. Yeah, as Graham mentioned, we're going to be thinking about the resurrection today. Of course, last week was Easter Sunday, and that's all about the resurrection. We looked at some of the witnesses to Jesus' resurrection in John chapter 20. And what I want to do this morning is ask questions like, how do we know that's all true? How do we know we can trust those witnesses? Over the next few weeks, we're going to look at different aspects of that question, minus Mother's Day. And today what we're going to do is look at a basic overview, a framework, an outline of how you can go about answering the question, how do I know that Christianity is true? Let me start by telling you a little story that I think will be a good illustration. Back at many years ago when we were at Ballagera Baptist Church, we had an evening service for a while. And after the evening service would wind up, some of us went over to the local McDonald's and had an ice cream cone. It was kind of our tradition. And one night on a Sunday, after the evening service, we drove over to McDonald's, we parked our cars, and we're about to walk in. And there's this car in the drive-through line that sort of swung out of line and swung over near us. And the lady rolled down her window, and she said, "Did you see somebody just running off from here?" And we said, "No, we didn't see anything." And she says, "Well, he just opened up my passenger side door and stole my purse and ran off." And she's starting to get really quite upset, actually. And so we said, "Look, you should really call the police, you know?" And because she didn't know what to do, she's getting a little hysterical. So she called the police. And then after that, she called her husband. And she's getting quite upset now. While she's waiting, we decided to sit with her and try to keep her calm instead of going on into the store. The husband arrived before the police did. And the husband's getting very angry, and you know he feels, "I want to get this guy," this kind of thing. When the police showed up, probably not the same officer, but I don't know. When the police showed up, the husband marched straight over to them and started going, talking, you know? And the I could visibly, I already knew that the officer doesn't want to talk to this guy, but I could see it. He visibly was trying to, you know, walk past the guy, and the guy's walking sideways and yammering at the policeman. Does he want to talk to the husband? Absolutely not. So I started walking over there. But I know the policeman doesn't want to talk to me either. He doesn't care what I have to say. He doesn't care what the husband has to say. So when I went over to the constable, I said three words. I said, "She's over here." That's all I said. The only person that the police wanted to talk to in that incident was the woman from the drive-thru. Why is that? Because she's the witness. Apparently I got ahead on my frames there. Because she is the witness. She's the only actual eyewitness to what happened. What I say doesn't matter. What the husband says doesn't matter. The person who saw the incident, that's what matters. Now, when I am telling someone the gospel, I want them to be like that police officer. I want them to be asking, "How do I know this stuff is true? I want to hear from witnesses." If I want them to be like the constable, then what I need to do is the same thing I did that night at McDonald's when I said, "She's over here." My job is to point the person to the witnesses. Listen to the eyewitnesses themselves if you want to know whether Christianity is true. And that is the point of this 1-2-3 framework. For getting your head around how we know Christianity is true, there are mountains of books written on this topic. I've got a book this thick that is only about whether Jesus' resurrection is true. And here's the funny thing. The type of argument that the man uses is called a minimal facts argument. It's similar to the structure of the outline that I'm going to give today. Now, you can't remember all of that evidence and all those details. Nobody can. I can't. If I'm talking to someone about the resurrection, I don't have all of that in my head all at the same time. That's not the purpose of this. I don't want you sitting here thinking, as we go through the points of this outline, I'll never be able to remember all that. That's not the point. You can use this framework anyway, and I will show you how. So for now, just listen as I explain the framework, and then I'll talk a little bit about how it works. Let me tell you, though, that the inspiration for this framework is nothing other than the apostolic model of evangelism. Christians have lots of ideas about how to witness to others about Jesus Christ. And I thought to myself, why not do it the way the apostles do? Does that make sense? I mean, we have the book of Acts for a reason, don't we? I'll tell you what I've noticed going over the book of Acts many, many times in the last several years. The apostles major on the resurrection. Of all the aspects of our faith, they always come back to the resurrection. There's not a single time they try to evangelize someone without getting to the resurrection in the book of Acts. And when it comes to the question of why you should believe the resurrection, they always point to eyewitness testimony. We saw it. Here's a few examples. Peter, on the day of Pentecost, said, God has raised this Jesus to life, and we are all witnesses of it. In Caesarea, Peter said, he was not seen by all the people, but by witnesses whom God had already chosen, by us who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. And then there's Paul in Pisidian Antioch, who said, God raised him from the dead, and for many days he was seen by those who had traveled with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. They are now his witnesses. So this framework is an attempt to follow that model and to put the idea in a nutshell in an easy-to-use outline that we can use in our daily conversations without having to memorize all the mountains of facts about the historicity of the resurrection. How does it work? Well, the one in 1-2-3 is that there is one central claim at the heart of our faith. There is only one thing on which Christianity stands or falls. If it's true, Christianity is true. And if it's not true, nothing else that we believe or do matters at all. It will come as no surprise to you, after what I've already said, that this one central claim of Christianity is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Think about how Paul said it in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 17. If Christ has not been raised, your faith is useless. Every song we sing, every book we read, every sermon we hear, none of it is good for anything if Jesus is not raised life again. No apostle of Jesus ever in the New Testament says that anything else is quite that important. There are other important issues, but nothing is like this. Nobody ever says in the New Testament, if you don't really feel the love and joy of God in your heart, your faith is in vain. The apostles never say, if that kid in that movie didn't go to heaven during his appendectomy, then your faith is in vain. And they never say, if God doesn't heal you or fix your marriage, your faith is in vain. And I could go on and on. It is the one thing at the heart of our faith, the resurrection of Jesus. Let's say somebody really wants to talk about creation and evolution, and you spend several weeks and you convince them that evolution is false. Now you've got a non-Christian out there who doesn't believe in evolution. Just think about that. It's the resurrection. We always have to come back to the resurrection because that proves the gospel that Jesus is Lord. And I've noticed reading the book of Acts that it doesn't matter what the apostles start talking about, they get to the resurrection every time. So, for example, Peter at Pentecost, the mother of all evangelistic speeches, he starts off talking about this speaking in tongues business. But that's not really that important. He uses it as a stepping stone to get to the resurrection of Jesus. And that proves that he is the Messiah. Similarly, in Acts chapter 17, Paul in Athens, talking with pagans instead of Jewish people, he starts off talking about the Athenians' own religion. But he doesn't, their religion isn't that important. What's important is that he can use it as a stepping stone to get to Jesus' resurrection. And so that's what I attempt to do with this step one in 1, 2, 3. Whatever I am talking about, I am trying to get to the resurrection of Jesus. If not, I'm wasting my time. That's how we can follow the apostolic model on this one. Always make the main thing the main thing. First things first. Second things second. Get the conversation around to the resurrection of Jesus. So, for example, how about this same-sex marriage business? I, years ago, had a coworker who was a lesbian, and she was interested in God. We were pretty close friends. And she had said to me that she would like to be a Christian, but she just couldn't. She knew God hated who she was, and she couldn't change that. I said, well, look, let's not worry about your orientation for the moment. Look, I do think that the Bible says that homosexuality is wrong, but let's leave that for the moment, because here's the thing. If Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, it doesn't matter what the Bible says about your orientation. It doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. But if Jesus was raised from the dead, if that's true, you need to understand that and what it means about who he is. And then you can work out what that means for your life and your lifestyle and your romantic relationships. Does that make sense? Get the conversation back to the main thing. You've got plenty of time to handle secondary questions after that. Get the conversation back to the gospel. So, not only does that follow the example of the apostles, it also makes life a lot easier for you as an evangelist. You don't have to become an expert in philosophy and history and geology and cosmology and everything else under the sun. You can focus on the thing that matters most. Makes things easier. So the one in 1, 2, 3 is to remember the one central fact of our faith, the resurrection of Jesus. What's the two? I mentioned before an approach to arguing for Jesus' resurrection called a minimal facts approach. And I've seen scholars use as many as 12 minimal facts. I've seen them use 6 or 4. That large book that I was talking about uses 3 minimal facts. That whole book is about 3 facts, essentially. Believe it or not, I think you can really boil it down to 2. 2 minimal historical facts. There are 2 historical facts which are virtually indisputable, and only the resurrection of Jesus adequately explains those 2 facts. What do I mean by historical facts? Well, I mean a couple of things. First of all, there is overwhelming historical evidence for their truth. We don't have time to go into all that evidence this morning, and we don't need to. You don't need to memorize that evidence. You just need to know it's there. You need to know that these facts are historical bedrock that you can rest on. And I'll explain how you use it if somebody denies one of these facts. I'll explain what you can do in that kind of case. So in the first place, there's overwhelming historical evidence. They are as certain as just about anything from history. Was Napoleon at Waterloo? Did William the Conqueror defeat Harold at the Battle of Hastings in 1066? These are things that we take for granted. These 2 facts have that level of evidence or better. And because they have that much evidence, There are virtually no professional scholars in any relevant fields who will deny these two facts. I'm not just talking about Christian scholars. I'm talking about Jewish scholars, atheist scholars, agnostic scholars. I'm talking about scholars of the New Testament. I'm talking about ancient historians. All of it. Doesn't matter their worldview. If they are an expert in a relative field, in a relevant field, they agree with these two facts. To find someone that does not agree with them is like finding a scientist who denies the moon landings. They're pretty rare. What are these two facts? These are the two facts that require an explanation. Fact one is that Jesus truly died on the cross. That's a real historical event that professional historians and scholars, nobody disagrees with. He was a real person. He really died on the cross. And fact number two, there were witnesses who truly believed that they had seen Jesus alive again after his death. Now, hear me carefully. Every word there is significant. I am not saying that the majority of scholars believe in the resurrection. The majority of scholars don't believe that these witnesses were correct, but they do believe that the witnesses truly believed what they were saying. Does that make sense? Okay. So my point is that if these two facts are true, I don't know why that keeps jumping on me. Oh, no, we are in the right spot. Now we're not because I messed it up. We're way back. Okay, if these two facts are true, they require an explanation that makes sense of both of them. And I believe that only the resurrection of Jesus makes sense of both these facts. This type of argument can be misunderstood. Somebody might say to me, yeah, so what? Jesus died. That doesn't prove he was raised to life again. Lots of people die. Or they might say to me, yeah, okay, let's say the disciples really believed he was raised to life. That doesn't mean they were correct. This is not the argument. The argument is not that each one of these facts on its own proves the resurrection. The argument is that for both of these things to be true, there needs to be an explanation, and only the resurrection works. The resurrection explains them perfectly. The man died and was seen alive again because he was alive again. Pretty simple, yeah? That works. But as I said, most people, and even most scholars, don't believe that explanation. What are some alternatives to believing in Jesus' resurrection? A skeptic who wants to deny the resurrection has got to do one of two things. He's either got to show that one of these two facts is not true. He's got to show that we didn't land on the moon. Or he's got to come up with an explanation for them that works as well as the resurrection. That's fair, isn't it? Here's just a couple of alternatives to the resurrection. Some people have claimed that Jesus merely fainted on the cross. He lost a lot of blood. He was in a lot of pain. He passed out. They thought he was dead. They took him down and put him in a tomb. Later on, he came to. And he walked out, and everybody said, oh, he's raised from the dead. Now, there are a lot of problems with that idea. But you don't need to memorize all the ins and outs of the argument. You just need to remember two historical facts that all professional historians agree to. And somebody tells you, yeah, I don't think Jesus really died. All you have to do is ask a couple questions. You can say something like, did you know that even atheist historians agree that Jesus died on the cross? Since all scholars agree to that, I'm curious what the evidence is for your view that Jesus didn't die. You see what I've done? If he wants to say the moon landings didn't happen, the burden of proof is on him. It's not on me to go and try to disprove every outlandish idea that people come up with. He needs to convince me that his outlandish idea is true. Do you understand? And if somebody really wants to know what the evidence is that Jesus truly died, here's what you do. That is a great question. Let's get together next week and talk about it. And that gets you time to brush up on those facts. Does that make sense? You don't have to have an encyclopedia of evidence in your head all the time in order to witness to the truth of the resurrection of Jesus. So that's one possible explanation. Another one that people say is that, well, I think the disciples were lying. They didn't really see Jesus at all. This is the same kind of problem. They are denying something that all scholars agree to, even non-Christian scholars. The burden of proof is on them to explain how that could possibly be true. What motive did they have for lying? What did they gain from it? And so on. So a lot of attempted explanations of the facts actually deny the facts. As reasonable people, that's not where we want to be. Are there any alternatives to the resurrection which don't outright deny historical facts? Well, yes, there are. Let me just give you a few examples. So these are examples that agree to both of these facts. Some people have said, you're going to think this is a red herring, but this is true. I'm not making this up. Some people have said Jesus had a twin brother, a long-lost twin brother that nobody knew about. And this twin brother happened to be in Jerusalem by coincidence when Jesus was on the cross. And apparently he saw Jesus and he thought, wow, this is finally my big chance. I've always wanted to pretend to be resurrected from the dead. And when they put Jesus in the tomb, 3 days later, he went walking around pretending he was Jesus raised to life again. No, it doesn't deny either one of these facts, does it? It agrees that Jesus truly died, and it agrees that people actually believe they saw him alive again. Here's another one. And again, I'm not making this up. This is one someone actually said to me. Maybe Jesus wasn't miraculously raised from the dead, but maybe he was healed by aliens from outer space with advanced medical technology. So that doesn't deny either one of these facts, does it? But can you see the straws that we're grasping at to get away from the resurrection? Can you see that? How implausible and wild the theories have to get? I hope I'm not the only one that thinks that those are just ridiculous on the surface. Let me mention one more alternative, because this is a really important one. This is the one that most scholars believe. Like I said, most scholars agree to these two facts, but they don't believe the resurrection. So what do they think happened instead? It will be some version or another of the hallucination theory. The witnesses to the resurrection were hallucinating. They truly believed they had seen Jesus raised to life again, but it was their mind playing tricks on them. They so loved Jesus and so missed Jesus and so believed that he was the Messiah that they just could not accept that he was dead. And this denial drove their brains to manufacture hallucinations of Jesus. And this is not a joke. This is what most scholars who are experts in the history actually believe, a hallucination. And it's at this point that it becomes very useful to have a three in the 1-2-3 framework. The three can come in handy for a lot of other reasons as well, but let's see at how it helps address the hallucination theory. So one was about the one central fact of our faith. Don't spin your tires talking about things that don't matter. Talk about Jesus and his resurrection. That's the gospel. Two, there are two minimal historical facts that all historians agree to because they're well evidenced and they need an explanation. And the best explanation is the resurrection. Three, what kind of witnesses were there to the resurrection? There were three kinds of witnesses. In the first place, there were the disciples of Jesus, his followers. Could they have been hallucinating? Did you know that about 15% of the population will have at least one hallucination in their lifetime? Did you know that? Now, by hallucination, this could be any one of your senses, not necessarily visual. This could be a brief and momentary one-off hallucination. And there can be any number of causes for hallucinations. But even then, even talking about such minor hallucinations, About 15% only of the population will have a hallucination in their lifetime. But we're not talking about 15% of Jesus' apostles, are we? And we're not talking about them having brief one-off hallucinations with any one of their senses. If you have a sense that someone's in the room with you, you just feel it, that counts as a hallucination. We're talking about something much different with Jesus' apostles. We're talking about 100% of Jesus' apostles believing that they had seen him visually alive again and heard him for lengthy appearances multiple times over the course of 40 days. And they all had the same hallucinations, sometimes at the same time. From what we know scientifically about hallucinations, this is pretty much as big a miracle as the resurrection itself. If you're going to believe this hallucination theory, and this is the most plausible theory next to the resurrection, and the hallucination theory gets even worse when you think about our second kind of witness, opponents of Jesus. And the best example here, and if you want to, the only one you even need to use, is Saul of Tarsus. Saul was an enemy of the first Christians. He was not grieving Jesus' death or missing him. He was not wishing to see Jesus alive again. And yet even he had an experience which he truly believed was Jesus alive again. And everything that I have just said about Saul, who's later called the Apostle Paul, of course, everything I've just said about him is agreed to by the overwhelming consensus of scholars in any relevant field, not just Christians, but all of them. This is a historical fact you can take to the bank. An enemy of Jesus came to believe that he was alive again. Now, we've already seen that the hallucination theory doesn't work even just for the disciples, but it certainly wouldn't work for an opponent of Jesus like Saul. He was the last person on earth that was psychologically in a state where he might have a hallucination of Jesus. So he helps prove that Jesus' resurrection was not a hallucination. It's also not likely that it was a lie. I don't think you can argue the disciples were lying. You certainly couldn't argue that Saul was. He had nothing to gain and everything to lose. What's the third kind of witness? Let's consider that briefly. And that is women. I'm thinking of women like Mary Magdalene, Salome, Mary, the mother of Jesus, Joanna, the other Mary. There's too many Marys in the New Testament. Why do I list the women separately as a separate category? Well, it's not because I have anything against women myself. But it's because, in a sense, the ancient Jewish people did have something against women. There was often a lot of doubt and debate about how reliable the testimony of a woman was. I don't think it's fair, ladies, but that's how the culture was. They didn't think women were very reliable witnesses. So here's the thing. If you were making this up, if you wanted to invent made-up witnesses and say that they saw Jesus alive again, you'd say it was people whose credibility nobody would doubt. You'd say it was priests and rabbis and stuff, wouldn't you? You wouldn't say it was fishermen, tax collectors, and women? Not in that culture. You wouldn't say that. The women were the first witnesses to the resurrection. And so they greatly strengthened the argument that the resurrection was not a lie or a made-up story. Now, once again, we have not gone into all the ins and outs of the arguments. We have not gone into all the details of the evidence for this stuff. You don't need that. I mean, the more you know, the better. But you don't need it. This 1-2-3 framework, can we all remember 1-2-3? One main fact, two historical facts, three kinds of witnesses. This is meant to be an introduction and an outline for the truth of Christianity. You don't need to remember everything there is to know about the historicity of the resurrection in order to use this in your daily life when somebody wants to know why you are a Christian. So, how can you use this framework? In the first place, I encourage you to use it as a guide for your further growth and learning. Pick some part of this framework that you'd like to know more about. It can be easy for us to look at a big topic like apologetics, like evidence for the resurrection, and say, somebody else in the church can do that. I don't think I can learn all that. Don't worry about learning everything. Just worry about learning a little bit at a time. You can do that. I've recently started teaching a few people in the church Greek. And one of the guys in the class, I won't name him by name at the moment, but he gets really panicky thinking about all this stuff he's going to have to learn. And I've had to say to him, slow down. All you need to worry about for the next 2 weeks is the alphabet. You see? Just take it one little bit at a time. Use this framework. Ask yourself, what little bit would I like to learn a little bit more about? And look into it. I can help you with it. Use this framework to guide your further growth and learning. The second thing that you can do is actually use it to guide your conversations with non-believers. And you can start that now with this framework in mind. How would you do that? Does anyone remember this book, if you were here last year when I shared about this book with the church? It's called Tactics by Greg Kokel. It's an excellent guide for the manner in which we go about sharing our faith. If you haven't read it already, I'm recommending it again. You can borrow my copy, or there are a few others floating around in the church. Now, what you can do is use the 1-2-3 framework to help organize your thoughts as you do the kinds of things that Kokel recommends in this book. And that means mainly asking questions. Asking questions is a great way to get an opportunity to tell people the gospel. Be polite, be respectful, and ask sincere questions, and you can use the 1-2-3 framework to help you figure out what's a good question to ask now. So I'd like very briefly, before I finish up, to go through a hypothetical conversation just to give you one example of how this could work. I'll first remind you of a few other rules of engagement from Kokel's book. So you always want to be polite. You always want to be gentle. You are not out there trying to make non-Christians look foolish or stupid. You're not trying to hammer into them how wrong they are. You're trying to encourage them to think better and to see the truth. So you always be respectful and gentle, even when you make a powerful, powerful point. Do it in a way that they can save face, and there's a chance they might come to learn and accept the gospel. Kokel has a good rule. When you're talking to a non-believer, if you get mad, you lose. If they get mad, you lose. It's a very good rule. I would recommend sticking to one point at a time. In my experience talking to non-Christians, they want to jump from one thing to another, especially if they feel that maybe there's a weakness in this point. They'll jump to something else. Gently ask them, can we just resolve this one point before we jump to talking about something else? Can we talk about that one next week? Right now, let's just talk about whether Jesus really died. Does that make sense? That's going to help. Kokel also recommends if a non-Christian makes a good point or brings up something you haven't thought of, acknowledge it. It's not going to kill you to say, gee, that's actually a really good point you've got there. Or, I haven't thought of that. Give me a couple weeks to think that through and look into it, and next time we talk, we can discuss it. Don't be afraid to ask for more time to think about something. And if you get to a point where the other person doesn't want to talk anymore, or they're just being belligerent and rude and you don't think it's going to go anywhere, just politely excuse yourself and get on with your life. It's not worth your time. Find someone that is willing to listen. Does that make sense? All right. So quickly now, here's a hypothetical conversation that will be using Kokel's tactics along with this 1-2-3 framework. So say a friend comes to you and says, yeah, I don't know how you could possibly be a Christian. Doesn't make any sense to me. Evolution is a proven fact. Let's say that you believe evolution is false. You believe it's the dumbest thing you've ever heard. You believe the earth is obviously young. Let's say that is a really serious thing for you. whether you believe in evolution or not, you could remember the one in 1, 2, 3. Your job is not to convert people away from evolutionism. Your job is to convert people to Christ, the resurrected Lord. And so I would say something like, did you know that there are lots of Christians who believe in evolution? Did you know that there are lots of non-Christians who don't believe in evolution? Do you want to know the one thing which all Christians need to believe? You see what that does? Gently, politely, it gets us on the right track to talk about the thing that matters. Let's say that works. There was one time I tried that and it didn't work. And the guy kept wanting to make me be a six-day creationist. And so I ended up excusing myself and said, sorry, I'm interested in Jesus. You can worry about evolution after you decide whether he's Lord or not. It's not that big a topic. When you're ready, I'm willing to talk about the truth of Christianity. If you just want to go beat up on creationists, there's other places on the internet you can do that. Is that fair? Why am I going to waste my time? But let's say it works. Let's say the person is willing to talk about the resurrection. And he says, yeah, I bet the disciples just made it all up. Now you can remember the two in 1, 2, 3. You know that the overwhelming majority of scholars think that that's a stupid idea. And the evidence is dead against it. And you might be tempted to launch into telling him why that can't be true. They died for their faith, all this other thing. That's not what you do. You let the framework inspire a question to ask them. He says, I bet the disciples just made up the resurrection. Again, if he wants to deny the moon landings, the burden of proof is on him. And it's the same here. He says, I bet the disciples just made up the resurrection. And you ask something like, really? That's interesting to me because even skeptical scholars and historians think the disciples really believed what they said. I mean, they don't think the disciples were right, but the experts don't think that they were lying, so I'm curious what the evidence is for your view. See, I've been polite. I've asked a question. I've given them a chance to back up what they've said. How do they answer? There's a few possibilities. Let's say he goes, they probably just imagined that they saw him. Maybe they did believe it, but they probably just imagined it. Again, I can launch into how stupid an explanation that is, but instead I'm going to ask a question. Again, I'm going to say, well, okay, I'm willing to consider that, but I don't know of any scientific evidence that groups of people can have the same hallucination at the same time. Could you point me to some resources on that subject that I could read? So I'm assuming that he's able to back that up. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. Stay calm, take your time, and have some fun with it. Now here's the tricky thing. What if he says, well, I do know of a scientific study, which shows that people can easily be tricked into thinking they saw or even did things that didn't really happen. Have you heard of that study? That's a real study. It was published in 2006. There are some major flaws in the study's methodology and its conclusions, but you don't need to know all that. Let's say you've never heard of this before. And he says, I've got this study that proves that people can remember things that didn't really happen. Here's what you do. I'd like to read that and think about it. Point me to it. I'll read it, and next week let's have a talk about it. See how easy that was? See how I have nothing to be afraid of? This person cannot bring evidence that's going to scare me. In the first place, I already have a solid confidence in the resurrection of Jesus. And in the second place, if he does say something I'm not expecting, all I do is say, I'm happy to think about that. Let's talk about it again. Easy as can be. Now, what if one day you do manage to convince someone that maybe Jesus did raise from the dead? That allows you to talk about what it means for who Jesus is. He's the Lord and the King of God's kingdom. And what it means about what Jesus' death meant. He died for our sins. The resurrection is the cornerstone of our faith. And when you put that in place, all the rest of our faith can follow from it. That's when you can start talking about how long it took God to create the world or whether same-sex marriage is okay or whatever else. First things first, second things second, just like the apostles did in the book of Acts. Can you guys remember 1, 2, 3, do you think? Is anyone going to use it? Do you think it would be helpful? Would you be interested, just let me know after the service sometime, in having a little pocket pamphlet or guide or something with a summary of some of this information? If that would be helpful, let me know. If you think this whole framework is stupid, let me know that as well, and I'll go back to the drawing board. That's fine. Always remember, I'm available if you've got questions, if you want to learn more to be prepared, or if you are actually already in conversation with a non-Christian and you want to know how to address something, just drop me a line and I'll see if I can help. Another thing you could do is come door knocking with me in the neighborhood and we could practice this together. I'll just put that out there. And you can come along tonight to our discussion group, 7 o'clock here at the church, if you've got more questions and want to think more about this. Now, I've called this a framework for witnessing, but it's actually not. It's actually a way of pointing people back to the real witnesses, just like I did in that car park in McDonald's. She's over there. What I want to do is encourage people to listen to the real eyewitnesses who saw Jesus risen from the dead. So this is actually a framework for not witnessing.